and welcome to the fifth edition of the Martlet Roundtable. We have two exciting guests for you here today. We are joined by editor-in-chief of the Martlet, my boss, the best man in the whole world, Hugo Wong.
Hello.
We are also joined by Caitlin Rosenberg. Introduce yourself.
Hey.
Hello.
I'm Caitlin.
Former Martlet staff, former Martlet editor.
Sure.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. I wrote a food column for two volumes, and then last year I was on staff, so I'm well-versed in the Martlet universe.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. What, yeah. Tell me, because I know, the listeners might not, what was the name of your food column? Tell me about it.
Eat, Choose, and Leaves.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I have to give credit, Mark Yunker.
Oh, really?
Was the originator of that.
Oh, Mark.
Yeah. That's a great name for a column. So tell me about your time with the Martlet. How did you enjoy? How long were you here for?
I guess in total it was 3 years, so it was almost my whole school career at UVic.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I definitely liked it enough to continue to come back. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took my experience, and now I write for Eat Magazine in Victoria. Yeah.
Tell me about that. How did you get started with that? How's your experience been so far with Eat Magazine?
I think it kind of came about unexpectedly, as most sort of writing jobs do. They were looking for writers to join their new website as, you know, a publication that's been around a while, but they didn't really have an online presence, which you think, okay, it's 2014-15. That's a little strange, but all right. Got on board, started writing monthly stories, and now I'm in the print issue, so
that's fantastic.
It's great, yeah.
So. Tell me a little bit about Victoria's sort of cuisine. What are your three favorite restaurants in Victoria?
My three favorites are Uchida, which is a little hole-in-the-wall Japanese restaurant.
How do you spell that?
Uchida.
Okay.
It's in the same building as the Bug Zoo downtown.
Oh!
Yeah. Okay. So they don't have like a huge sign on the street, but you go in there at lunch, it's really busy. It's not, you're not going to get like sushi rolls, you get a lot of bowls and little, they have lots of little bowls of little things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it, what kind of setting? Is it like an intimate sort of place or?
I think intimate would be a nice word. It's bustling. It's tiny. It's okay. Bustling. You go in there. Everyone is there to eat. And that's
perfect.
Really, yeah.
What's another one?
Zambri's, which is in the atrium.
Zambri's?
Zambri's.
How do you spell that one?
Zambris. Oh. Okay, we're having a spelling test.
Yeah,
this.
No, that's good because I was like, Zambris. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's Italian. It's a little fancier. It's good for special occasions. Yeah, pizza, pasta.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the setting's quite nice.
It is. Yeah, it's the atmosphere. You get some good Instagram pictures there. They
have the large windows help, right? As long as you get a window seat, then it's perfect for that.
Yeah.
What's number three?
Number three is Thai Lemongrass, which is actually just down the road, Cabarrow Bay. That's my favorite Thai place. I don't know. It's just the pad Thai there is
perfect. And
that's
perfect. In Cabarrow Bay Village, right?
Yeah, right across from Peppers.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Hugo, what are your three favorite restaurants in Victoria?
Oh, gosh. I don't have time to eat out a lot.
Right.
In terms of ones that I would go to... I can't even. What I will say is, we went to Thai Lemongrass like once, I think, Katie together, and I have been going a few more times now, and you know what, I do like that it's not a really pretentious place. The booths are a little small, I'll be honest, but you know what?
It's... Wow. Okay.
What?
So he goes all about the decor. That's fine.
The ambiance.
Well, what? Decor is—it's the kind of thing where you have to sit down. You have to be in the right mood. You can't.
So more broadly, how would you characterize Victoria's food culture? Is there a sort of emerging trends or anything like that, or is there a type of restaurant that you know you haven't seen in Victoria you'd like to see?
I think in general, Victoria diners are really focused on health.
Okay.
They're focused on where the food came from. Is it local? Is it from the island? I think that's a big push right now to have a lot of the products that make up your dishes be grown on Vancouver Island. Even Phillips Brewery right now is trying to get all their own malt and barley grown on the island, which is going to be a big feat, but they're trying, and that's a push. Relaxed dining as well. Ulu restaurant, also just rebranded to Olo. So they're going from kind of an upscale place, the same owners, chefs, all that, more relaxed. The menu is, you know, a little less expensive. So that's just kind of a shift, right?
So like more casual, but casual. Like locally grown things?
Yeah, for sure. 10 Acres is a good example of that. They have a lot of menu items where, I mean, 10 Acres, they have their own farm. You go in, it's very casual in there. I don't know if you've been.
No.
Downtown as well. Actually, just one up from government, so.
Perfect. So it's kind of nice. That's interesting because I always picture the demographics. I mean, I haven't been here very long. Mm-hmm. The demographics of Victoria are a little confusing to me. I never actually know what the average Victorian sort of dining habits would
really
be like.
Really hard to say.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing a lot of businesses open up. They're going after a high-end market.
Really?
I'm not sure if they're going to be sustainable, but it's nice to see that they're trying.
High-end market meaning in terms of menu price or?
Both. So there's a lot of juice places opening up, and I think a bottle of juice on average is $10.
Holy wow. Ma! Ten? What?
Right. So, I mean, high-end ingredients in the juice, it's all organic.
Oh, my God.
So that's one example. There's a lot of coffee places in town where you're seeing coffee from different roasters across North America and in Victoria. Okay. Again, a cup of coffee, five plus.
Okay.
So I think there are items that you're not going to eat on a daily basis, although these places are hoping you will.
Right. Okay.
I think in places like Vancouver, you know, Portland, this might be a little more normal.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll see. We'll see in a few years if it's stuck.
Something that you reminded me of actually was Nourish. Mm-hmm. It's a restaurant. It's by Camosun College Interurban, I guess. It's on a farm, really much off the beaten track. There's an interior that's, I think, a classroom portable.
Oh.
And then exterior is by a garden, and it's one of the more unconventional restaurants that I've been to, but I really enjoyed it. I did some photos for it for Concrete Garden magazine last year, and it was really impressive. They have what's that ice cream? It's not
I'm not quite sure.
It was an ice cream sandwich, but it was a tequila, lime, and coconut ice cream. Is a Cold Comfort.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and that's where they source their ice cream from, and it's so lovely there. That and so now I have thought of my top three now.
Okay.
A little late, but no, Il Terrazzo is a place that I really like. It's by Willie's Bakery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's across
near Market Square.
From Market Square.
Mm-hmm. The prices are a little bit higher, but not so high that it's not super high for what they're offering. They have an incredible wine selection there, although it is very, very busy. So it's the kind of place where you do have to take reservations for. And then the other one is Big Wheel Burger.
Now we're talking.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this place.
It is by Cook Street Village. I'm pretty sure it's by the same owner as Zambri's, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
And they're focused on sustainability as well. Everything's recyclable.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
You can throw everything out.
They grind their beef fresh every morning, so that way they can have just the tiniest hint of pink in the center, but that's still okay. Prices are quite reasonable, I think. You can get away with a burger and fries for under $10 there.
That's great. Burger-wise,
so I actually ate there today for lunch.
All right.
And I have a story about Il Terrazzo. A little less great. Went on a date there, first date. The man I was with didn't have enough money to pay for this, as Hugo puts it, a little higher price but worth what you get.
Right.
So I, you know, helped him out.
Right.
Anyways,
did he say explicitly, like, I have no money?
He didn't come out right away. He really tried to get his car to work.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's horrifying. Yeah. That's horrible.
I know. Oh, so bad for him. Oh,
that
wow.
That sucks. Did you, like, have to, like, sort of spare him the embarrassment and be like, it's okay?
I mean, I definitely did that. It didn't really go anywhere.
Oh.
Was it because of that, or is it because of
that? Hugo, this podcast is about time. Food, okay?
So okay, well, We're talking, while we're on the topic of burgers, I think one of the worst kept secrets is Bin 4, obviously, right? Now, Bin 4 caters very much to students after 9 p.m., right? I mean, do any of these restaurants you mentioned to have sort of that student in mind when they, like this Big Wheel Burger, is that somewhere that students go to?
I think it can be. I mean, the prices are lower than Bin 4. They don't have the after 9 p.m. special, No, they don't have anything like that. But
Bin 4 is doing so well that they already have a location in Langford. They're opening one up right now in the Accent Inn.
Really?
Which is sort of in a strange, I don't want to say industrial area, but it's close to Uptown, so.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I think
so. I like that, though. That's It's a really cool atmosphere in there, too, because there's really no bones about it. It's, you know, everyone there is under 30 after 9 p.m. Like, the half price thing, you can't beat that. This is not a... Though we're not in the service of advertising for Bin 4, oh my god,
it is really good. Intimidated by their selection of dips.
The aioli.
That seems a bit extravagant,
many.
Actually. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite?
I've only tried the truffle oil one.
Okay, so my favorite is the basil.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a lot of aiolis.
Yes.
It's a lot of,
I mean, it's really mayonnaise, but...
exactly. Fancy
the presentation mayonnaise. Is excellent. At Bin 4, that's for sure.
So Hugo, you brought something up earlier. You said you took photos for a magazine, right? So Hugo, for the listeners out there who don't know, Hugo's a jack of all trades. Hugo used to be a photo editor. If Hugo takes photos to this day, Hugo's done everything. I'd love to know, Hugo, what you think of sort of how the volume is going so far. Volume 67, that's our year right now, the issues you're reading right now. And sort of what's this general dynamic of, you know, student journalism and where it's headed.
Okay, in terms of the volume, I think it's, well, I am contractually obligated to say that it's going wonderfully, but I really do think so. This year we had a concerted push to focus, at least in the news section, a little more campus-related stuff. It's the kind of beat that not a lot of other, well, I don't think any other publication in Victoria really goes into. I mean, UVic is more or less its own little town. So it's nice that we can kind of have exclusivity there. In terms of the state of journalism, you can go on and on about it. I mean, I just downloaded the BuzzFeed iPad app the other day, and you know what? I was very impressed. I was very impressed. I think last year these kinds of organizations got a lot of flack for appealing to that lowest common denominator, but I don't think, like, they've been steadily moving up as we here at the Martlet have been sort of thinking about how these kinds of shifts affect us.
You know, okay, the BuzzFeedification, to coin that term, how would that affect campus publications?
It affects campus publications in the way that it affects student consumption habits. Most people now are looking to breaking news to timely content on their phones or else on their computers. The print copy is very much a weekly roundup of what's been going on. Some people have said that by reading the print copy from front to back, there's a sort of resolution that you don't get online, whereas you just get a continuously scrolling feed. And it just proves how we need to reach the audience that we want to reach.
Print, though. Okay, let's talk print specifically now. Because we all know, as we've already alluded to, the online presence for any sort of publication it's not even a must. It's the number one sort of thing moving forward. Our print mandate, though, what does it serve for students, that sort of print edition that can't be sort of made up online, in your opinion, Hugo?
This is very much anecdotal, but I spoke to a couple people last week or 2 weeks ago, sort of during the student election time, and they were really pleased with how it's just something that you can relax with over lunch, as opposed to something that you look at while waiting for something.
Right.
It's really about how media consumption fits into their daily life. For someone like myself, you know, I wake up and the first thing I do is I check my Facebook newsfeed for the kinds of media outlets that I subscribe to. But for a lot of people, sometimes older people, reading the print copy is something that they relax with on a Saturday or a Sunday. Right. And so the kinds of stories that you'll see in print and the kind of, you know, the layout and presentation is something they don't really get online.
Caitlin, what do you see the role of the print edition specifically, of not just the Martlet, of any campus publication in general? Because you also work for a magazine that has the sort of two lives as well.
True. So I think, speaking about the Martlet, when you're a student at UVic, you kind of have this special gift where you have a paper just for you.
Yeah.
And you kind of take it for granted, then you leave. It's like, oh, there's no paper just for me anymore. It's just every paper trying to cater to a general audience. So I think for students that don't read it, that's maybe a way for them to get into it more, that it is really targeted for them.
The print edition or just the Martlet in general?
In general, but okay, of course yeah. The print, it's there everywhere. How can you not pick it up? It's in every building, right?
Right. I guess it kind of depends on what Hugo was just saying, the media consumption habits. Perhaps people now, that's not the way they imagine reading things is in print.
True, and I think getting back to the BuzzFeed style, when I read their stories, I'm only going there for the long form. I don't need to see the lists and the GIFs.
Right.
But maybe for other people, they come there looking at a quiz of what Disney character they are, and then they get led down a link path that goes to a long form article, and that's how you're going to bring more people in.
Right.
There's a small percentage that already read the great long form journalism that's printed online.
Yeah.
We're not worried about those people. It's everyone else, right?
You're absolutely right. That's a very good point. So, if that model can be used successfully, and I know Hugo, in our editorial meetings, you're actually quite complimentary for the way that BuzzFeed's taken their direction in terms of how they're able to pay their journalists and do their, not that, you know, which Disney princess are you, but would that be something you suggest to student publications? Having that sort of two-faced kind of approach to it, where you have like, come on in for this, you know, clickbaity stuff, but stick around for this Senate meeting. You know, is that sort of something you'd suggest?
I think that would be something to test out. I don't know long-term if it's going to work.
Well, I'm pretty sure that BuzzFeed is really growing their news division, but I don't know if they're consciously shrinking their, like, lol division.
No, for sure. And
but it's sticking around.
Was it last week or the week before they had the dress controversy?
Oh, God, yeah.
The black, blue, white, gold.
Wow.
And I follow one of their long-form writers on Instagram. She posted a photo of their office there having a party, just an extremely long table filled with bottles of champagne. They got 26 million hits in a span of a few hours. They were celebrating. So
that's amazing.
For employees like her, she's reaping the benefits and the monetary value of a post, which was two photos. And
and you know what? This is something that I've been discussing with other people, is that, I mean, people will look at legacy publications such as the New York Times as something that's a model for, you know, this greater good altruistic kind of publication. But you know what? They have their wedding section too.
Absolutely.
You know, they have arts and culture and other things that are just different forms of service journalism.
Yeah.
BuzzFeed is by no means the first to employ a version of this, but they're certainly one of the few media organizations right now that are thriving because of it.
And they're able to, the elephant in the room is, as you just pointed out, you know, I'm sure if they have a table full of dumb, that they're able to monetize that traffic, right? And that's something that I think, no secret, I think that student publications struggle with how to monetize
their
And that's not really a student struggle. That's a struggle for every publication in Victoria.
I mean, one of the big reasons that we lavish a lot of our attention on the print product, well, not just because there's, you know, a firm deadline of a Wednesday morning, got to get this to the printers.
Right.
It's also a really important source of ad revenue.
Yeah.
No one has figured out, well, I think BuzzFeed might be the exception, but a way to substitute print ad revenue for web ad revenue.
Right, right.
And it's not equal right now. I think, you know, in the early 90s, well, mid 90s, early 2000s, there's definitely a culture online that's developed that everything is free.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely.
And that's very difficult for people to shake off. I mean, people are now getting into stuff like in-app purchases. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe one way to do it, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, things like paywalls. I'm not sure. I mean, and for, you know, the listeners who don't give two hoots about student journalism and the sort of dynamics of print media, I mean, it's important to imagine how these people are, how they've sort of grown up receiving information in general. I mean, a lot of these people now, if they're in first year university, a lot of them haven't even grown up with television news. Like, so I would imagine that, like, the print edition of the Martlet, even if it is almost like almost an anachronistic sort of callback to a different time, it is cool. It serves a purpose even in that. But yeah, ad revenue in print, like, not that we can really, like, that's not really something that is too interesting to talk about because, as you might imagine, it's not easy to get ads, you know, breaking news. But I just wonder about the future of sort of the style in which we try and drive, you know, readers to the websites. Because I'm curious, you know, especially for people listening right now, like, what drives them to go check out a link? You know, what drives them to actually click things? You know, and if I am, look, we've all clicked on Vice stories, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, clickbait works. It works. Mm-hmm. It absolutely it does. Yeah. I mean, Gawker Media, it's amazing what they've been able to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. And so to continue to sort of deny that would be probably perilous, but at the same time, is that even something we would, you know, consider as part of our mandate? What do you think?
You know, it's really hard to say because, you know, we're a very high turnover organization. I was speaking to somebody from the Huffington Post a couple months ago who said, you know, writing good clickbait is hard. I think he was a person in charge of it's colder in Canada than it is on the moon right now.
Oh, jeez.
This was a little while back.
That happens a lot every year. It's colder in Edmonton than it is on Mars.
Yeah, something like that. But I think that student newspapers are really lucky in that there's a small, like, a few dollars per student that goes to it. And so that's a kind of a small safety net where we can fund, you know, really serious, but maybe not necessarily popular things. Although, you know what? That's not necessarily a choice. We've had run stories about, you know, profs making potentially controversial statements online and sort of exploring the role of, you know, neutrality in that sense. And that was one of our most popular stories. The election was the highest traffic story this year. So, I mean, these are the kinds of stories that require a significant amount of investment in time and effort from people who are, let's face it, they're full-time students, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is just on top of whatever course load and extracurriculars they have going on. But in terms of popularity, I don't really think there's a choice. It's just a matter of deciding how much time you want to spend generating that traffic. Right.
That's a good point. That the point about the sort of revenue we receive from students, the levy, it gives us the mandate to sort of go and cover the Senate and do things that, like, you might not, you know, we don't have to. And then on top of that, some of our most traffic stories are also campus affairs stuff. But I guess that sort of reminds me of the way that the CBC is telling people in Canada, like, who else is going to go to some of these locations if there's no money to be made? We rely on federal funding because Canada is so large, right? And that's something I always think about with CBC funding. And I think that, like, the campus publication is sort of a mini CBC in a way. It is a mini publication.
I mean, who's going to know that UVic just approved a visual arts minor, so people who want to take photography or other courses, they can, or that, CARSA is a little bit behind schedule or something. These aren't the kinds of stories that would interest the other publications in town. And you know what? That's okay, because they have their own niche, and we have ours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the sort of mandate of a student publication compared to, like, a...
I agree with Hugo on the content, that it's really focused for the school. For my 3 years when I was at the paper, you know, I obviously read it every week, and I was keeping up with all the other news on campus, so it just seemed like a no-brainer to me. But my roommates, you know, maybe I'd go home and say, oh, there's a new minor. Well, why would we know about that?
Right.
If you don't want to know the information, if you're not even going to think about searching it out, I don't know how we get to those people. Maybe they just don't want to be gotten.
Yeah, I mean, you know? The point is, at least as long as we're here, or as long as publications all around Canada are here, North America, that information will be there for those who want it. And I'm not sure if we can...
From a publications standpoint, like from a management standpoint, one of the things that we've been trying this year is to really actively get the message out. I mean, all publications have their own methods. I mean, years and years and years ago, you know, there'd be... you know, newsies, you know, people yelling extra on the street corner. But in now, it's people who are interested in sharing stories socially. And we've been trying, you know, really hard to promote the stories that we print, because I think over the last year, we realized, like, we were publishing really relevant content that wasn't necessarily getting to the people who need to know it.
Yeah.
And so by putting a lot more attention into the way we promote our stories, particularly online, I think that's that's been really helpful. It's hard to quantify. I mean, you can say that, oh, you know, we had twice the amount of hits this month than last month, which is good. But it really starts to hit home when you start talking to your friends and to just random people who say that, oh, yeah, I read this thing. I've heard about this before. Right. And that's nice.
So, I mean, I guess back to what we were sort of referring to before with the sort of kinds of ways that people engage with information in general. Let's do Martlet Roundtable confession time.
Oh,
what is the way, like, what is a type of click that you will get you every time? Because I'll start first. So I'm an avid consumer of sort of sports media. I'm no bones about that. Sports clickbait is, I mean, clickbait in sports is just, it's one of the oldest ways of sort of communicating their stuff online. Like today, this morning, there's a story from a sort of insider dressing room dynamics. That's what gets me every single time because these guys have access. The one thing that bloggers largely do not have is access to dressing rooms. And anytime there's any sort of juicy sort of gossip about dressing room dynamics, that stuff just drives clicks like you wouldn't believe. So the point with, I guess I was thinking about with that is the reporters themselves have that access. We have that access here on campus. Other campus publications have that access. Would there be a way of sort of, you know, driving clickbait through that kind of access? Because that is something we do have. We have, you know, a staff writer sitting on the Senate board shorts, bless his heart, you know. That kind of stuff. What do you guys think about that? Or, first of all, answer my question. What kind of click gets you every time?
Okay, so mine are blind items, which is celebrity gossip, but they don't say the celebrity's name. So they'll say, this A-list celeb who just got divorced from a prominent television star, and then yada, yada, yada. There's sort of like some mystery behind, and really the best part of those is the comment section. So I'm a big lurker in the comment sections.
Yeah. See, the smart thing with the A-list thing is, if it's A-list, you know it. It's not going to be like some...
The harder one's the B-list, because you're like, okay, like... Have they fallen from grace? Are they trying to?
Do
get
they
up
say
to
this B-list celeb got hit by a truck and never guess who? Or like, is it? Or do they have like a, that delineation that hard? Or do they just sort of assume everyone's an A-list? That's
there's some B-listers out there.
Do they say that though? These sort of clicks? Oh no way!
Well, that's just exploiting. I think it's called the curiosity gap.
Oh yeah.
Right, and I mean that's been happening.
What's that? Explain that.
Well, the most effective headlines are the kind of things where you read it and you're like, oh, I have to know more about this.
Right.
There are certain headlines where you're going to say like, oh yeah, that's the most important information at the top, and if you want to know more, keep going.
Right.
But anything that just makes you like want to keep going. I mean, for me,
what gets you though?
Me. Last night, I read a story about the creation of Mad Men and the five to 7 year long process
Matt
Weiner
took.
Yeah, and it was just it was kind of a Q&A. So the reporter talked to all the main cast and some executives from Lionsgate and stitched together this narrative of stuff that we hadn't known before necessarily.
Did they bait you into the clip though?
Oh yeah, well because there's. It's sort of, well, I love Mad Men, and they talked about, well, the last half of season 7 is coming in, what, April? Is it April? I think I'm pretty sure it's April. And so, you know, this is a show that's been going on since the late 2000s, and it's affected fashion, it's affected sort of the influence of small cable channels on award shows. It's captivated people's attention, even though it's a very slow period drama, which by all accounts shouldn't. And you know, I'm always like you, I'm always a sucker for behind the scenes stuff. It's what people in the biz call TikToks.
What is this called?
TikToks? Yeah. Narratives of how bills become law, or how
Kesha fans thing. Also TikToks. Yes.
That's
a good joke.
Wow, that would be such a meta article.
Oh god. The creation of TikTok. So
you're a fan of sort of like the insider politics sort of thing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean I
think you're kinda like skipping the question, like, what's your guilty?
I want to know what gets you though.
Anything from the Daily Mail.
So like, what is that?
The worst British tabloid in all of history.
Is that like Bat Boy, or is that
no?
It's kind of, it's similar to BuzzFeed, but it's mostly focused on celebrities.
Mm-hmm. It's mostly focused on celebrities, and I'll make no bones about it. It's incredibly judgmental. You look through it and you're like, oh my god, I feel really bad reading this, but at the same time, you just can't stop.
And then do they use the sort of same tactics?
They do sort of all the things that you would never teach anybody, you know, right? Half their money is probably from David Beckham and their family.
Okay, all right. Wow.
Do the
Royals do? I'm guessing the Royals.
Yes, okay. The Royals do feature in. Oh God, who's dating? Was it Romeo? Romeo Beckham, isn't that right?
Romeo Beckham.
I'm pretty sure that's
Who
one
on
of the boys.
Earth is that?
I'm gonna let you finish this.
I believe is dating Chloe Grace Moretz. I do not know.
What? How old am I? How old is David Beckham's?
This David Beckham's kid is, I want to say anywhere from 15 to 18.
Oh my
I don't
God.
Know.
Oh my
but they'll
God.
They'll do stuff like that, and like it's. You read it and you're like, this is really bad. They're doing a really bad thing. Like, I don't need to know this.
Why am I reading this?
But at the same time, you can't look away.
Okay.
And a part of me that to me sort of, you always know, I'd like to think you always know yourself best. And when you're judging like audience reactions, you might not share the same reaction that your audience might, but somebody, statistically speaking, would. And so you can, even though you don't agree with the approach, you can kind of see why it works.
Right.
And if you don't agree with it, as I wouldn't in my own work, then you can kind of try and figure out how to do it the hard way.
Yeah.
And, you know.
All right, final thoughts here, guys. 2025, future Hubbard students of the Martlet, pick up the Martlet in some way. What does it look like? Caitlin, you're first. Is there a print edition in 2025?
There's definitely a print edition.
There it is. All right.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does it exist in the same way, or is it some bizarre new type of print, like the Daily Mail?
I'm going to go and I'm going to say that it's going to just be physically smaller.
Oh, it's going to be like a 4-page paper at that point? Or
I feel like it'll be more like a flip book. I don't know why. I think the print's going to stay, but maybe there'll be more of like an artistic approach to it.
Does Eat Magazine exist in 2025?
As
a magazine, exclusively, or is it only web, or is it's I suppose you've got a conflict of interest here, saying, "Oh yes, it'll be great. It'll be 40 pages."
Well, it has been around for 15 years already, okay, so it has a pretty good track record. I'll say yes.
Okay, Hugo, what's the Martlet look like?
I actually see it as a monthly magazine.
A monthly, okay.
I can definitely see depending that. On sort of how our structure changes, we might be better. We might double down on the fact that people read print because they want to get a sense of resolution. They want to get more think pieces, more long form, reflective kind of stories. Whereas breaking news is going to be online, and you see this this move in certain American student publications where they're supported rather by journalism programs.
Right.
Some of them have moved direct, like completely onto Medium. At least they're long form pieces, and they have a breaking news website. Besides. So something like that, I think, would be really nice, a monthly or bi-weekly.
All right.
Okay, so Hugo kind of said what I said, but like better.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with his.
Good, for me, good call.
Martlet will be it'll be a vial that is sold. And this is in 10 years, by the way. It'll be a little vial, like if you've seen The Wire, like the way they sell drugs. And you pour it out and you snort it right out. And all the information you need will just be snorted right into your brain. So I think you guys are both, you know, missing the point here. I think that we should be trying to make the Martlet into a powder that can be consumed and be really cool. Also, it'll be illegal.
Watch the septum deviation, though.
No, that's encouraged, actually. Like that. So, that's it for this week of the Martlet Roundtable, their fifth Martlet Roundtable. Thanks so much for listening, and check back next week for more Martlet drug-related news.